Political Horizon, the podcast from thegeopolicy.com. On 15th of August, it will be 1 year since the fall of the Kabul government and America's departure from Afghanistan. We all remember the images from the airport. And for this, we will be publishing a deep dive of Afghanistan in the past year. We've got Adnan Khan, the founder of Geopolity, to give us some information on this and go through some of the points of the deep dive. How are you keeping, Adnan?
I'm good, Yusuf. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good. Now, a lot of people are still trying to figure out why America's occupation failed in Afghanistan.
Okay. Fundamentally, Yusuf, America's occupation failed much down to the same reasons the occupation of Vietnam failed after so many years. They went to war with some very questionable objectives. Very quickly, they got embroiled in a protracted war. And rather than saying it's not going as planned, they kept lying and saying things are going really good. They've turned a corner. And then very quickly, the objective changed from some tactical outcome to not losing became the objective. So rather than winning and winning is X, it literally came to the point where not losing was the objective they're there for. So leaving Afghanistan would be embarrassing. It will impact America's position. Therefore, America has to stay the course. So they lied about the capabilities of their regime that they established. They lied about the security services that they poured loads of money into. They lied about women's education and general stability in the country. And it just took 20 years for people to work out what was going on. So from that perspective, it was always going to end in this type of failure. It was just a matter of how they were going to depart. And really, it's the same sorry story as Vietnam in the end.
Now, obviously, now the Taliban are back in power. And how have they got on since they've taken over? If we start off with their governance, how's that been?
Okay, so just days after Afghanistan fell, I think literally a few days after, the Taliban gave their first press conference. So you had Zabihullah Mujahid. He made his first public appearance. He was known to be a Taliban official. And he gave that famous press conference where he spoke in English. And for the first time, you actually saw the Taliban not on the battlefield, but as politicians. And really, the first year, there's been some successes. There's been a lot of challenges. And just, you know, to mention for this podcast, we did actually get in contact with the Afghan Information Ministry for this deep dive. We sent a number of questions to them and they kindly actually responded and actually provided quite a detailed response to a lot of the issues and questions we raised. And a lot of what they've said, we've incorporated into the deep dive, which will be coming out on the 15th of August. So obviously, probably the most famous thing that happened in the first year was the establishment of their government. There was a lot of claims when they took over, the Taliban are back, they're going to oppress the people, they're going to oppress the opposition, they're going to massacre, carry out a bloodbath on the opposition. And unless they created a broad government where they incorporated all the minorities, nobody really gave them any hope. The odds were really against them. But the Taliban inherited a dysfunctional country from a two-decade occupation. The government America established was non-existent for most people. It was corrupt. There was no rule of law, even though America was pouring loads of money into it. So if you put everything aside, the Taliban started from a very weak position. They inherited lots of problems. And we're just looking at 1 year. 1 year really isn't a long enough period to judge the performance of a government. If we were to do that to an American president, it would be unacceptable for anyone. However, the ministry provided us with a lot of explanation of what their priorities were and what they tried to do. So we now have an interim government in place in Afghanistan. That's what they called it. So unlike China, where the ruling political party is the government, in this case, that's not happening in Afghanistan. You've got the leader of the Taliban, Habibullah Akhundzadeh. He didn't actually take up any official role in the government. He remains the supreme leader of the movement. But what they established was an acting prime minister and two deputy prime ministers to him. And these were taken up by some of the founders of the Taliban. It includes Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, who led the peace talks, or what led to the peace talks in Qatar. And then you had a 33-member cabinet And what you find is this includes people that are on the American terrorist list. So you've got Sirajuddin Haqqani, famous individual from the Haqqani network, who are on America's terrorist list. And interestingly, the Taliban actually retained most of the government employees that were there from the previous regime. So they say the Afghan ministry provided 440,000 personnel that were there running the American-led government, they've actually maintained. So you've got a hybrid government now of new individuals from the Taliban and those from the old. And that's very unique because in Afghanistan, the opposition don't work together. And that's why historically the Northern Alliance have fought the Taliban and the Taliban have actually fought them as well. Now, there was speculation the Taliban might reach out to former Afghan officials such as Hamid Karzai. That didn't really transpire in the end. However, the government the Taliban have established, it looks remarkably similar to the previous foreign-backed regime. There's not been any explanation or outlining of their emirat, the Islamic principles they're going to be based upon, the Islamic system of governance. What you see is an acting prime minister and two deputy prime ministers, which is very similar to what the previous was. And this actually led to some divisions in the Taliban. You've got those people who want to go back to what the Taliban did in the 1990s. Then you've got another faction that believes to get more international recognition, we need to be a bit more savvy and we need to change. However, one thing that has definitely come across that across Afghanistan, the daily violence has completely gone. There used to be people dying every day because people were settling scores and there was no law and order. That's completely gone. And in fact, Taliban have a bit of history of this. The areas they rule in, you get a level of stability because the Taliban are sincere and they're not there to make money or be corrupt. And this is actually what led to the Taliban to emerge in the 1990s. And a similar thing's happened again here. So that's really what they've done on the governance side for the first year. So obviously, it's still a long way to go. And I'm sure we'll touch on the other aspects, so such as the economy and foreign policy.
It's interesting that you mentioned that the daily deaths have actually gone down because I know security was a major thing when the Taliban initially took over, especially with the minorities such as the Shias and the Uzbeks and the Tajiks. Can you give us more information about that?
Effectively, Afghanistan was a jungle and might was right. Despite the fact that America established a government and it said the government was doing a really, really good job, the reality was, as we know now, it was corrupt. It was ineffective because the money America was pouring in, the government wasn't utilizing it or using it for the betterment of the country. They were using it for them. Now, there was a lot of Western claims when the Taliban took over that the Taliban will carry out a bloodbath, it will carry reprisals. And there's a bit of history here. Generally, when a new regime emerges in Afghanistan, you see the targeting and the massacre of the previous regime. This happened when the Taliban took over. This happened when the America put in Hamid Karzai and his government. So the previous government was from the northern parts of Afghanistan, the Northern Alliance, and the Taliban are from the south. They emerged from Kandahar. So they're Pashtun, largely, whilst the northern Afghans are a mixture of Tajik, Uzbek ethnicity. However, the bloodbath that the Western media were presenting, it didn't actually happen in the end. In fact, the Taliban came to power and they gave an amnesty to everyone that was part of the previous regime, men or women. Now, this is very, very, very unique. You don't get this in Afghanistan. And this actually led to a high degree of stability. In fact, many people have said in wide interviews that they were more confident of sending their children to schools, of letting their children go out, because the Taliban have a history of protecting the highways, of protecting the key routes. This was something that was sorely lacking when the previous regime was in power, because they would steal, they would bribe, there was literally no law and order. The only people the Taliban went after were the senior members of the Secret Service and some commandos. And that is actually because these people actually did carry out atrocities against the Taliban. So even when the Northern Alliance took over in 2001, they actually put many Taliban officials in container ships. And they basically died because of the lack of oxygen. That's the only area. The stability had been corroborated by many Western officials who went to Afghanistan over the years, and they went back after the Taliban took over last year. And they actually said that it's much more safer. There's much less security, visible security on the streets, because the violence has gone down. What they all said is the primary driver of the violence was the foreign occupation and the government that supported the occupation. Now that the foreign occupation has gone because it's been defeated, the primary reason for violence has also disappeared as well. And because the Taliban haven't gone after and gave an amnesty to all the previous regime, you can see why the violence has actually gone down.
Another thing that we see on Western media is the Afghan economy is in free fall and it's on the verge of a humanitarian disaster. Is that right?
So like the rest of the problems that Taliban faces, they inherited an economy that was really built upon a pack of cards. 80 to 90% of Afghanistan was run by American aid, it was run by foreign money. And America was prepared to do this because they wanted to create the image that they've done a successful nation-building project. So when the Taliban took over, America stopped providing that money, and America even seized the central bank currency reserves that were sitting in America. And subsequently, Joe Biden has said half that money will be used now to pay the victims from 9/11 who have got a lawsuit against Afghanistan. So the Taliban have definitely inherited it's been a big struggle. We asked the Afghan ministry what was the plan of the regime and what they've been doing for a year. And they actually provided quite a detailed list. What they said is that, yes, we inherited a mess. And actually what made it worse was the fact that they were being sanctioned by America and restrictions were being put on them. That actually made it far worse. But Taliban, again, were already starting from a very, very weak position. So what the Taliban have done, according to the Information Ministry, is they've got some of the mines working again. They've tried to get some of the previous deals that didn't go anywhere with the Central Asian countries to get some of the pipelines working and some of the resources working again. What they've also tried to do, and probably the biggest challenge they've got, is food. So aid agencies have actually been allowed to go into Afghanistan and actually provide food. Obviously, most of Afghanistan, 75% of Afghanistan is rural. Only about 25% is urban areas. So the majority of people live in rural areas, so they live on subsistence farming anyway. And for them, the previous regime never really provided for them anyway. So in that sense, the Taliban doesn't need to really worry too much about feeding its population because most people live on subsistence farming anyway. They live in rural Afghanistan. But the trouble they're going to have really is in the long term of becoming self-sufficient. So Afghanistan does have some resources. Donald Trump used to always talk about the trillion-dollar reserves Afghanistan has got. They've been talking to everyone, the Chinese, the Iranians, the Russians, to get these projects working again. So in the first year, the Taliban have just tried to maintain a semblance of order. However, significant economic challenges do remain in the medium to long run.
The Taliban announced in July that they would not be opening girls' secondary schools after saying for several months that they would. Now, this is a big claim against the Taliban. A lot of people are saying that they are against women and they want to keep them as second-class citizens. But it seems that the decision, it's caused a wedge between the Taliban as well. How do you see that?
So the number one claim when the Taliban took over was women's rights is going to go in reverse. Children's rights are going to go in reverse. Only the West and the Western-backed government actually gave women any rights as well. So this claim has continued as things have gone on. And yes, the Taliban did do a U-turn. They said from the beginning, in fact, the first press conference, they said once they've got their feet under the table, they want to reopen the education sector. They want everyone to go to school, men and women. So this was a pledge they made. And the West constantly called them out on that pledge. When are you going to start this? When is this going to start? To the point where you've got a country that's been at war for 4 or 5 decades. I mean, education is probably a more longer term priority than an immediate priority. Immediate, you'd think, is security and economy. However, the picture behind this was a bit more complex, not as black and white as they've got an issue with women. So the problem the Taliban has had is the Taliban is not one monolithic movement. Although the West likes to proclaim that Taliban is a movement and they're all on the same page, that's actually not the case. What you find is since the Taliban have come to power, there's actually been divisions on a couple of things. Firstly, the first division within the Taliban is, well, actually, firstly, in Kandahar, you've got the supreme leader of the Taliban. And the government of Afghanistan, that's run by Taliban members from Kabul. So Mullah Baradar and his deputy ministers, these are the government that operate. But the supreme leader, he is based in Kandahar, and he maintains his relations with all the different tribes and the different families. Now, what's happened is a number of areas of divisions have occurred. Firstly, many Taliban officials feel there don't seem to be much difference between the government they've got and the previous government. The previous government they fought, and they feel we've just established a government that's completely like the previous government. Like, what's different? We're supposed to be an Islamic government. So you've got those people. Then you've got the other faction that believe that, look, to get international recognition, we need to be different to the way we were in the 1990s. We lost the goodwill of the people because we were really, really harsh, and we've learned our lessons. And this is leading to quite a bit of tension, actually, between these factions. So in a famous gathering, the supreme leader, Akhundzad, he was meeting a number of tribes. And one of the tribes said to him that, we fought for decades against foreign occupation. And if there's one thing you're going to do, yeah, don't open secondary schools. And that seems to have led to the decision by the Taliban leader to announce that secondary schools weren't going to open. And what this shows you is a couple of things. Firstly, the tribes are not actually against women's education. The madrasa system has historically been the Afghan system of education. The Western school system is about 100 years old in Afghanistan, and that's seen as a westernization attempt of the country. So when they stand against women's education, they're standing against Western schooling, which they see as westernization. But what this shows you is the Taliban have domestic audiences whose needs they have to meet. That's their support base. And that's why you find when this announcement was made, the Kabul Gamal was shocked, and even some of them even spoke against it. They said, we made promises to the international community. How are we turning back on it? So what it shows you is Taliban unity and actually maintaining the support of the Afghan tribes. This is more important than millions of girls, whether they should go to school or not. However, Yusuf, the World Bank actually published a report on Afghanistan in May, where they looked at security and education, and they made some very interesting observations. According to them, there are now more girls in education than there was last year under the previous regime. So overall, more girls are going to schools now than there was before. So obviously you've got primary schools, secondary schools are not open, and then you've got the colleges. More people are going to schools today under Taliban rule than there were previously overall. And the reason why is because the people in Afghanistan trust the Taliban. They honor women, they protect women, they don't abuse them. So people are confident to send their children, their females, to actual school. That wasn't the case previously. The previous government was corrupt, the officials were corrupt, everyone was a law onto themselves. So what that shows you, Yusuf, is it's a bit more complex, this picture. It's not as black and white as people are making out. They hate women, they're going to oppress women, and that's what's going on here. If anything, when we asked the information ministry regarding this, they actually said to us that one of the reasons they did a U-turn on this was that if they are going to open secondary schools, they need to be able to protect the women. So that means they need coaches, that means they need Islamic school uniforms, that means they need to protect the roots. And they can't do that at the moment because a lot of their money's been frozen by foreign countries. So that was their explanation on this. So yeah, overall, women and education is a more complex picture than it's made out to be.
Now, how have the Taliban been in terms of their relationships with other countries, particularly America? Because obviously we had the assassination of Al-Qaeda leader, and basically America's just stepped all over Afghan sovereignty. What do you make of that?
Okay, so the Taliban, since they've come into power, they've been trying to talk to everybody. So Pakistan, Iran, China, India, and the Central Asia nations. They're trying to show we are not the secretive and isolated Taliban of the 1990s. We're a new Taliban 2.0, and they want to talk to everyone. Their view in America is quite interesting. So the ministry told us that what's happened is for a decade, they were talking to America. Negotiations were going on. A peace deal was agreed. Now, a lot of that peace deal, we don't know the details. We know the main detail from the peace deal is America will withdraw by a certain date. And so long as Afghanistan is not used by international terrorists, America will leave. Now, eventually, America did leave despite an extension to the deadline. The other details we don't know, but one thing the ministry did tell us was America, since they took over, America's placed sanctions on them, America's put restrictions on them, and America's gone back on a number of the agreements they actually made. And they're considering breaking some of the agreements they've even got with America as well. So what it seems to be is America is trying to isolate the Taliban despite talking to them for 10 years. And as a result of isolating them, they're hoping that they will give concessions. they will agree to some of the terms that America has. Now, for America, Afghanistan has always been about Central Asia. It's always been about access to Central Asia. This was an area that was under the Soviet Union. In 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, all this energy now had to get to the markets. So the American plan all along was that it would use Afghanistan as a forward base to effectively shift Central Asia away from Russia and link it to the international market. So linking it to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran, that's always been the American strategy. So America, it seems, it feels, but I say to the Taliban, that's how they'll get these concessions. So the relationship with America is quite sour at the moment. With the other countries, what you find is there's a lot of positive talk and there's been some development. So in the case of Pakistan, obviously Pakistan played a big role in getting the Taliban back into power, but Pakistan and the Taliban, they have it's a more complex relationship. And that's because Pakistan's military and ISI, they don't control the whole of the Taliban. Taliban is it's a wide group. It's not a monolithic group. You've got various factions, various shura. And Pakistan has influence over a couple of these shuras who sit on the Taliban leadership. They don't control all the shuras. So for example, Mullah Omar's son, Mullah Yaqub, he's got a prominent position in government, but he's actually been quite anti-Pakistan. And that border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, the Durand line, that's always been a contentious issue. As far as the Afghans are concerned, including the Taliban, that border doesn't exist. It should be further in Pakistan. So Afghanistan should be a much bigger country. And as a result, this Pakistani nationalism comes about. However, it was the Pakistan military and ISI that got the Taliban to the negotiating table. And they were the ones that forced through the peace deal in the end. So that's Pakistan. India completely lost out. India backed the Northern Alliance government, the previous American-supported government. And so they completely lost out when Kabul fell. So only last month did an official from India go and visit Afghanistan, because they realised now, if they don't get involved in Afghanistan, Pakistan will basically get the whole of the country and use that potentially against India. India has always wanted to get involved in Afghan affairs because it's the backyard of Pakistan. Russia has been talking to Taliban. It was talking to Taliban even before they came to power. Despite the Taliban and the Mujahideen fighting the Soviet Union in the 1980s, what Russia realized is the Taliban will be back in power one day, so you need to talk to them. So they've been talking to them, and obviously Afghanistan is linked to Central Asia, so what happens in Afghanistan will fall out there as well. So they've been talking to each other. There's been no major announcements of any deals, but the fact that there were enemies in the past, that's been put to the past. Iran obviously has influence in Afghanistan, in the north and the west of Afghanistan, and it's been talking about having positive relations, and it likes to criticize America that you've been defeated and you've gone. But Iran obviously wants the Hazara Shia treated well, and that's as far as the relationship's got at the moment in the first year. So I think that just leaves the Central Asian nations. So you've got Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, they have a border with Afghanistan. So Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, they recognize the Taliban government. They've been having talks. The Uzbek foreign minister, actually, probably the highest rank official, visited the Taliban at Kabul, and they actually agreed a debt payoff. I think the previous Afghan government actually owed some money to Uzbekistan, and that was agreed and it's been settled. Turkmenistan will be the route for the old pipeline, and that's in negotiations again. The only country that doesn't recognize the Taliban is Pakistan. So they've actually been quite anti-Taliban. They've actually been against the fact that they've come into power. They actually even refuse to accept the Taliban as the legitimate government. And a lot of this really has to do with the historical struggles Tajikistan's had with militancy, which come from Afghanistan as well. Also, one of the largest ethnicities after the Pashtuns is the Tajiks. So the Northern Alliance are largely consists of Tajiks. So Ahmed Shah Massoud and these guys, they fought the Taliban historically, and they got support from Tajikistan. So it's only natural Tajikistan would be against this. And the rumor is that the opposition to Taliban, they all got asylum in Tajikistan as well. So overall, I would say the Taliban are talking to everyone and they are trying to move forward, which obviously is a massive departure from the 1990s, where they didn't really talk to anybody. They were quite isolationist. They've tried to change that. However, you know, it's 1 year. Not much happens in 1 year. But they're trying to talk to China as well. In fact, Mullah Omar actually said that China is probably going to be our most important partner. There's no Belt and Road Initiative project going through Taliban, but the Taliban would probably want to change that. China actually did have two agreements with the previous government on One was a copper mine and one was another large mine. And because of the security situation, they weren't able to do anything. So the Taliban want to start up talks regarding that as well. So that's the foreign policy positions of the Taliban regime.
Thanks for your time today, Adnan. You gave a very interesting insight. I'm really looking forward to your deep dive. The deep dive will be published on Monday, the 15th of August, exactly 1 year anniversary. If you want to learn more about the issues raised today, you can check out our website, www.thegeopolity.com. And you can also learn more about other issues by accessing our website, where you find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and obviously the deep dive to come out. Thank you for listening.